What do you know about the Song of Solomon? I feel like most people believe it is a neglected book. We don't read it. We don't study it. You'd never hear sermons from it or Bible classes. But it is part of the Bible, and it's a very beautiful part of the Bible. My name is Stephen Medford, and I'm your host this morning for the Monday edition of Mornings for the Master. And I want to continue what we've been studying, but I thought I might take a break because of personal reasons and look at this book. I'm going over this in a class, and so it's easier for me to prepare right now. But the Song of Songs, the Song of Solomon, it is a love song between Solomon and what people call the Shulamite. It's a very beautiful song, and it emits emotions that are wonderful. Many people in the past have tried to allegorize this song, saying that it's not between a man and a woman, but between God and his people. And I think they do that because they are simply afraid to talk about the subjects that are mentioned in this book. They are uncomfortable, at least, talking about these things, because it does get somewhat graphic. I don't want to spend much time introducing the song. I'm just going to jump into it and talk about things as we need to. Verse 1 simply says, "The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's." And I think we can learn a lot just from those words there. It's called the Song of Songs. My first thought is, why is this called a song? Well, I understand because they sang it, but why did Solomon make it a song? How come it's not a poem? As part of the Bible, how come he doesn't call it law? Or this is the lecture of Solomon on love, or the teaching of Solomon on love? How come it's not just prose like many parts of the Bible? How come it's not written as a play? Why is it considered a song? And I think the reason is obvious. A song is more about the way we feel, like a poem, but not so much with the individual words, but how the words make you feel. But yet, unlike a poem, a song seems to emit even greater emotion than a poem. Consider a few verses. Psalm 137, starting at the beginning, we have a psalm here of when Judah is in Babylonian captivity. And this is what it says. "There we sat down by the rivers of Babylon. Also, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hung our lyres on the willows in its midst. For there our captors demanded a song from us, and our plunderers demanded gladness, saying, 'Sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land?'" So we have this idea of their sadness keeps them from singing. Isaiah chapter 24 and verse 8. "The gladness of tambourines ceases. The noise of those who rejoice ends. The joy of the harp ceases." So here, prophesying the destruction that's going to happen, they're not going to be happy. They're not going to sing anymore. The gladness of tambourines, the joy of the harps, it ceases. We have the same type of thing in Ezekiel chapter 26 and verse 13. "And I will cause the noise of your songs to cease, and the sound of your harp shall be heard no more." So the gladness that's in the land, the joy that's in the land, this is where the music comes from. And it's going to be gone. Again, in Amos chapter 8 and verse 10, "I will turn your feast into mourning and all your songs into weeping. And I will bring up sackcloth on all your loins and baldness on every head. And I will make it like the mourning of an only son. And the end of it will be like a bitter day." So we have the idea of songs and music being part of rejoicing. Another verse I think of is James chapter 5 and verse 13. "Is any among you afflicted? Let him pray. Is any cheerful? let him sing. So we have all these things that talk about songs being joy and cheerful. This is the song of songs. That's why it's referred to as a song. But consider what is meant by the song of songs. I think that's easily understood. This is the greatest song of any song. I wrote down in my notes here a number of passages that mention something like the greatest, referred to as the song of songs. For instance, in Exodus chapter 26 and verse 33. It talks about the Holy of Holies. We understand that this is the most holy place. It's the holiest of all. It's the Holy of Holies. In Exodus chapter 29 and verse 37, it talks again about the holy altar. And it says that this altar shall be a most holy altar. And again, it's the idea of the holy of holy altars. In Deuteronomy chapter 10 and verse 14, it talks about the heaven of heavens belong to the Lord our God. Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 2, vanity of vanities, as if to say this is the worst vanity there is. In 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 15, we read of the Lord of Lords and the King of Kings. This is talking about the greatest there is. And so when we read about the song of songs, we're talking about the greatest song there is. Some translations that I read say something like, for instance, the Holman Christian Standard Bible says Solomon's finest song. The Contemporary English Version says, this is Solomon's most beautiful song. The translation God's Word says, the most beautiful song of Solomon. Now, do you see a difference in saying the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's, and these translations? I think if you listen to these translations, the difference is obvious. This is not just Solomon's greatest song. This is the greatest song ever, and it happens to be Solomon's song. In 1 Kings chapter 4 in verse 32, it mentions that Solomon wrote 1,005 songs, but this is the greatest, but not just the greatest of Solomon's song, as I said. This is the greatest of all his songs. Although it was a woman who speaks in most of this song, I think it's interesting that this is still called Solomon's Song. Throughout this, the woman speaks mostly. What's the point I want to make there? Well, I'm not really sure. But it's Solomon's song, and the woman is singing most of it. To me, it's like, one application might be that they're one. The woman is singing, but it's Solomon's song. But another thing I see here is like this woman is Solomon's world. This woman is what gives Solomon joy, the way she is acting, the way she's responding. This is Solomon's song, and it has to be sung by her. This is what makes him sing. This is what makes him joyful. It is the woman. Now, before we end the thought of this is Solomon's song, a lot of people have an objection here. Do you have any objection to Solomon writing this greatest song about love and marriage? If you look at 1 Kings chapter 11, I'm going to read verses 1 through 4. It says, and King Solomon loved many foreign women, even the daughters of Pharaoh, Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, Hittites, of the nations which the Lord had said to the sons of Israel, you shall not go to them, they shall not go in to you. Surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love. And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines. and his wives turned his heart away. For it happened when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. So here, Solomon had 700 wives who were princesses, and 300 wives who were concubines. Now, anytime I mention concubines, I want you to understand, I always mention that concubines were not some type of illicit relationship. A lot of times people think that this was a sinful thing that was okay. All that a concubine was in the Bible was a wife who was a slave. She was a slave woman that Solomon married. And you can see this in a few places. In Genesis chapter 35, in verse 22, it talks about Reuben went in and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine. But in chapter 37, verse 2, it says, "These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, a son of 17 years, came tending the flock with his brothers, and he was a youth with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives." And so Bilhah was a concubine, but she was also a wife. And this, we see the same type of thing in this horrible story of Judges chapter 19. In Judges 19, I'm going to just start reading it. "And it happened in those days, no king being in Israel, there was a certain Levite residing on the far-off mount of Ephraim, who took to him a concubine of Bethlehem, Judah. And his concubine played the harlot against him, and went away from him to her father's house in Bethlehem, Judah, and was there 4 whole months. So a concubine he took, she played the harlot, which means she committed adultery against him, which couldn't happen unless they were husband and wife. Then verse 3 says, "And her husband arose and went after her." I thought she was just a concubine. Well, they were married, because he is her husband that arose and went after her to speak to her, friendly to her, to bring her again, having his servants with him and a couple of donkeys. And she brought him to her father's house. And when the father of the girl saw him, he rejoiced to meet him. And his father-in-law, the girl's father, see, they were married, kept him and stayed with him 3 days. So they ate and stayed there. And it happened on the fourth day, when he arose early in the morning, rose up to leave, the girl's father said to his son-in-law, 'Comfort your heart with a piece of bread, then go your way.'" But throughout this, we see that they were married. It was a legitimate relationship, but she was a concubine. She was a slave that was a wife. And so I want people to understand that just because they're concubines doesn't mean that there was something bad, inherently wrong with the relationship. But anyway, Solomon had 1,000 wives. And so a lot of people say, who is he to tell us how to live right with a woman? How to have a good marriage, a good relationship? Well, some people think that it was written before he had all these women. What we read in 1 Kings 11, it was when he was old that these wives turned his heart away from following God. So maybe it was later on in his life that he had these women. I think it's interesting that some people think, because of the lack of children that the Bible talks about Solomon having, usually it mentions the children of the kings to some extent, but Solomon's not mentioned having many children. If he had 1,000 wives, you'd think he had numerous children, but they're never mentioned. And so some people believe that he may have had many wives, but only saved his sexual relations for one wife. And he had just one special wife. And that's what this book is about. At any rate, I think it may have better equipped him, having many wives, it may have better equipped him to write a book like this. For instance, one who is monogamous all his life may be ridiculed by someone else who plays women and has lots of, air quotes, fun with women. Someone like that may think he's having a better time than someone who is monogamous all their life. Well, here Solomon experienced both things. He experienced lots of women, and apparently he experienced having a relationship with only one. And so, having both sides, he could tell you which one is better, which one is more rewarding. If you look at Ecclesiastes chapter 2 and verse 8, I know there are many translations that say something different from this, but most newer translations say something to the effect of what the New King James says. It says, I also gathered silver and gold to myself, and the treasure of kings and of the provinces. I got men singers and women singers for myself, and the delights of the sons of men, wives, and very many wives. And so if you think about the purpose of Ecclesiastes, in the book of Ecclesiastes, it seems like Solomon is going around trying to find true happiness, trying to figure out where it's going to be. And so he experiments with having lots of wives, lots of women, but he finds out that doesn't make him happy. That's not where true happiness is. So I think it makes him better equipped to tell us where what true love is like. Where is the most satisfying relationship a man and woman can have? It's going to be in one person singular. I also think a point can be made here that no matter how your morals have measured up in the past, you can always come back and have the relationship that God desires you to have. Solomon was not a good person when it came to relationships in many respects. God inspired him to write this book. And so the wisdom that is behind this book is not just Solomon's, but it's God's. And Solomon can attest to the fact that God is right in this regard. But as I started to say, it gives us comfort. No matter how you've lived your life, no matter what your situation is, you can always come back. Solomon experienced both things. He experienced many wives, and he experienced a loving relationship with one person. And so we can come back if we have failed in this regard and come back. So it's the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. And then it starts out, verse 2 says, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Now I'm going to say here that many translations tell you who is talking. And sometimes it is just up to the translator to decide. But often there are clues in the original language. For instance, when it says here, for your love is better than wine, it is a masculine singular, your. And so this has to be the woman talking to the man when it says your. So some of the pronouns gives us a hint of who is talking. Of course, when it says, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, that's obviously talking about the woman saying this to the man. But you can understand some from the original language a little more clearly who is speaking in different times. When it says, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, the verb tense here for kiss is translated, let him kiss me. And it expresses a wish or a desire, but it could also express a command. But I think the idea here is that she desires for his mouth to be on her. I want to say it's not wrong for us to desire this. This example shows us that this is right. This is set as an example for us. But it's not actually done. It's not actually fulfilled until the time is right. If you look over at chapter 2 in verse 7, we have a verse that occurs a few other times in this book. It says, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles, by the does of the field, do not stir up or awaken love until he pleases. And so she desires this, but they control their desires until it's the right time. Notice that she says that she desires this, but she does not initiate this. She desires him to kiss her, and not saying, oh, I want to kiss him. I think this is interesting, because she doesn't want to be the aggressive one here, even though she desires it. She wants him to be the aggressive one. And if we're going to compare this relationship to God and man, I think we can easily see that God desires us to desire Him intimately. God wants us to desire Him like this woman desires this man. Let Him kiss me with the kisses of His mouth, for your love is better than wine. The word that's translated love here has a root that is translated, or that means to boil. And it's used 39 times in this book. It has to do with lovers and lovemaking. But interestingly, it also is translated concerning relatives. Out of the whole Old Testament, this word love is used 61 times in the original Hebrew. It's translated beloved 35 times, and that's all in the Song of Solomon's, except for Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 1. In Isaiah chapter 5, verse 1, the only other time that is translated beloved, according to the New King James Version, that's where Isaiah pictures Israel as a vineyard. And it says, "Now I will sing to my beloved a song of my beloved concerning his vineyard. My beloved has a vineyard and a very fruitful hill." And so there it's used in Isaiah 5, 1. But other than that, it's only used in the Song of Solomon. It's translated love in the Song of Solomon 8 times. It's translated love in the Old Testament 8 times. And it's all in the Song of Solomon except for Proverbs chapter 7 and verse 18, Ezekiel 16 and verse 8, and Ezekiel 23 and verse 17. The other times it's all in the Song of Solomon. So 5 times in the Song of Solomon and 3 other times. And in these 3 other passages, it's talking about an intimate love between a man and woman. But interestingly, this word is also translated uncle in the Old Testament 16 times. So I think it could be a word that has 2 different meanings here, because it is translated uncle. I just think that's interesting. In the passages where it's translated love that are not in the Song of Solomon, Proverbs 7:18 says, "Come, let us take our fill of love till the morning, and let us delight ourselves with caresses." So obviously, you know what that's talking about. In Ezekiel 16, you might remember this passage where God finds Israel in its blood. It's a baby been left to die. And He picks it up and cares for it until it's old enough for marriage. And then He marries her. So in Ezekiel 16, verse 8, it says, "And I passed by you and looked on you, and behold, your time was the time of love. And I spread my skirt over you and covered your nakedness. And I swore to you and entered into a covenant with you, says the Lord Jehovah. And you became mine." In Ezekiel 23 and verse 17, it says, "And the Babylonians came to her into her bed of love, and they defiled her with fornications, and she was defiled with them, and her mind was alienated from them." So the point I wanted to make here is when it's talking about love, it's talking about the intimate love between a man and a woman. Your love is better than wine. This is what I want. I want you to kiss me. I want your love. And when she says better than wine, you should ask yourself, well, what's the comparison here? Better than wine. Wine here, it's more than just an alcoholic beverage. In the Bible, hopefully you've heard this a number of times, it's used for grape juice. And I'm not saying whether or not it's an alcoholic beverage here, but you know, if they usually had water, it would have been something special to have grape juice. They didn't have soda pops. They didn't have soft drinks. You know, this is what they drank. They had water, milk, and they had some type of fruit juice. And so the fruit juice was reserved for celebrations, whether or not it was alcoholic, which I think is important to note. So wine, of course, was special. It was, of course, much more expensive than water, and it was reserved for times of celebration, for rejoicing, for partying. But a couple of comparisons about wine, and I guess particularly the alcoholic wine, compared to this love, I wrote down a couple of things. First of all, it makes merry. It rejoices the heart. In 2 Samuel chapter 13, particularly verse 28, Absalom wanted to kill Ammon because of what Ammon had done to his sister. And it says there, Absalom commanded his servants, saying, "And watch when Ammon's heart is merry with wine. And when I say to you, strike Ammon, you shall kill him." So his heart would be merry with wine. We have the same type of thing in Esther chapter 1 and verse 10. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine. And a similar thing, but a different wording, is found in Psalm 104, verse number 15. It says, "And wine cheers the heart of man, and oil makes his face shine, and bread sustains the heart of man." Wine cheers the heart of man. And so when this woman is saying, your love is better than wine, your wine, which is special, it is costly, it is reserved for special occasion, your love is like that. It cheers my heart. It makes me rejoice. It's happiness. It's partying. It's great. But there's something else about wine that I think is significant. When you are with someone you love, it seems like the cares and disappointments of the world are meaningless. They're not as hard. Someone who you love can comfort you and sustain you through hard times. In Proverbs chapter 31, verses 6 and 7, it says, "Give strong drink to him who is ready to perish, and wine to those who are of heavy hearts. Let him drink and forget his poverty, and remember his misery no more." And so another thing about wine is that it causes you to forget your misery, your poverty, the things that are bad. A lot of times when we've had a hard day at work, we want to go home and we need to be loved by our spouse. It is comforting. It helps us. It keeps us going. And we need to make sure that our home is a safe place. I know of a lot of people who don't want to go home after work because there's more trouble there. Make sure our home is a safe place. Your love is better than wine. When I'm with you, I am happy. I am rejoicing. It causes me to be merry. It makes me forget my sorrow. And one thing that I think about often, I believe God gave us everything in the physical realm to show us something about the spiritual, to teach us something, to prepare us in some way. And I think God could have made wine with these attributes to show, because he wanted this in his word, to show what love should be like. This is what I want love to be like. Your love is better than wine. And of course, this is the woman speaking to the man, or speaking of the man. And it is significant that the man believes the same thing about the woman. If you look over at chapter 4, verse 10, it says, "How fair is your love, my sister, my spouse. How much better are your loves than wine, and the smell of your ointments than all spices." And so this is reciprocal. The woman rejoices to be with the man, loves the man so much, causes her to forget her miseries, makes her rejoice, and the man feels the same way about the woman. He goes on to say, or the song goes on to say, "Because of the fragrance of your good ointments, your name is ointment poured forth. Therefore, the virgins love you." Now, the punctuation is not in the original, so we don't know where the punctuation goes. When I read this, I read, "Your love is better than wine because of the fragrance of your good ointments." But it might be better understood the way it usually occurs in the versions of the Bible that you read. Because of the fragrance of your good ointments, your name is ointment poured forth. Therefore, the virgins love you. So, either way, your love is better than wine because of the fragrance of your good ointments. Therefore, the virgins love you. Because of the fragrance of your good ointments. Because shows the reason that his love is better than wine, or that the virgins love him. Because of your good ointments. This person simply has good smelling ointments, is what it's saying. But I think the idea is much broader than that. He cares about his appearance. He cares about what he smells like. He cares about what he looks like, how he is seen in public. This person puts on good smelling ointments. Baths and soap, I don't think, were as easily accessible in that day and time. And so people would anoint themselves to cover bad odor or just to make themselves more presentable. This is saying that the person cared for his looks. He took care of himself. He did not let his figure get out of hand. He ate healthy. He exercised. We all need to be good stewards of our bodies, the body that God gave us. Don't let it get out of hand. Don't be slothful. The Bible condemns slothfulness, laziness. We need to make sure we take care of what God has given us. And so it says, because of your good ointments. Now, more importantly, I think, she mentions specifically, your name is ointment poured forth. So more important than the way he smells was his reputation, the name that he had. It says, therefore, the virgins love you. All these young women want you. This is why the virgins loved him. His name is ointment poured forth. So what is a name? I already mentioned, it's the person's reputation. It's who the person is. A couple of verses here. In Isaiah 9, verse 6, a verse that you're probably familiar with. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be on his shoulders, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. His name is who he is, what makes him who he is. Because he is wonderful, he is a counselor, he is a mighty God, he is an everlasting Father, he is the Prince of Peace. Along these lines, Proverbs chapter 22, verse 1, a good name is rather to be chosen than great riches, and loving favor than silver or gold. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 1, a good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. So as we think about this good name, we have Ecclesiastes 7:1, a good name is better than precious ointment. And here it says your name is ointment poured forth. What is the comparison between a person's name and ointment? Why is it similar? Ointment, of course, here is talking about the way you smell, a pleasing aroma. It's what people would put on as cologne. It was people would incense their house with. And so, it's a good smell. Your name is ointment poured forth. A good name is better than precious ointment. What is a good name? What actually makes a person have a good name? I submit to you, we get our name because of what we do, because of our actions. This person was a good person, because he made good decisions and he did good things. Ointment has a fragrance that spreads and it would be well known. Your name is ointment poured forth. If you've ever spilt a bottle of perfume or cologne, or even if you haven't, you can imagine it would go everywhere. The smell would fill the area. It would drive you out of the room, for one thing. But it would disperse, and it would be a sweet smell for a long time throughout a lot of places. The works this person did were well. Everyone knew it. It spread forth. It was broad. In Matthew chapter 7, verse 16, This passage is talking about false teachers, whether or not a person is teaching truth or not. But it says, you shall know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes from thorns or figs from thistles? Look at this person's fruit. Is he producing good fruit? Is it well known to everyone? Is it ointment poured forth? In Proverbs 20 in verse 11, it says, even a child is known by his doings, whether his work is pure and whether it is right. Even a child is known by his doings. That's how a person is known. That's how you know who he is, by what he does. And so this person goes around doing good things. He is known for doing good things. His name is ointment poured forth, and this is the reason people love him. When you're choosing a spouse, you want to choose one that is known to be an excellent person. And if you're already married, you need to make sure you are striving to be an excellent person for your spouse. Verse 4, she says, draw me away. And then according to the New King James, it's the daughters of Jerusalem that say, we will run after you. And the you there is a masculine singular. So they're talking about the man that is being talked about. She wants him to draw her away. And the virgins are saying, we are going to run after you. And then this woman says, the king has brought me into his chambers. And then these virgins say, we will be glad and rejoice in you. And the you there is feminine singular. And so the idea is they are rejoicing in this woman. They want to run after the man. They are rejoicing in the woman. We will remember your love more than wine. And then the young lady says, rightly do they love you. So they love the man rightly. It is good and right to love this man. A couple of things from this verse. I like the idea of her saying, draw me away. The word could simply be translated take, but I think most of the time it's referring to a drawing. Do you see the difference? I compare it to a magnet. You don't grab her and yank her and take her away with you, but because of who you are, she is just drawn to you like a magnet. Draw me away. The word is used a number of times in the Old Testament, and you can look that up if you have your ability. It's used for drawing back a bow with an arrow in it. It's used for Joseph being drawn out of the well when they threw him in a pit. It's used for a trumpet. When it remains a long sound, they draw it out. And so that's the word draw. He's compelling her. She wants him to compel her to come to him. She is so wrapped up in him that she is swept off her feet and cannot help but be drawn to him. And I probably wouldn't have made this connection except for the fact right now I'm reading through the book of Hosea. And I thought this was an amazing verse. In the book of Hosea, chapter 2, Israel had been like Gomer, committing fornication, leaving God, not caring about God, worshiping idols, trusting in other things besides God and so forth. And God doesn't just say, okay, I'm through with you. I'm done. We have the picture of Hosea going out and actually purchasing Gomer again. And this is what God says in Hosea chapter 2 and verse 14. Therefore, behold, I will lure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably to her. So God is going to act in such a way that he is going to lure her, bring her to himself. And we have this in other places in the Bible. John chapter 6 and verse 44, no man can come to me, Jesus says, unless the Father who has sent me draw him, and I will raise him up in the last day. In John chapter 12, verse 32, and I, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself. The work that he has done is indisputable. We love because he first loved us. 1 John chapter 4, verse 19. We love. If God so loved us, so we ought also love one another. It compels us. It controls us. I think about 2 Corinthians 5. I think it's verse 14 that says, the love of Christ compels us. We see his good works. We see his love. We see the things that he's done. And it draws us to come to him to do what he wants us to. And then it says, the king has brought me into his chambers. It may mean here, and I kind of lean toward the idea that he chose me. The daughters of Jerusalem, all these virgins are at his disposal, but he chose me. They all want him, but he chose me. It could be that he has allowed me inside his innermost parts, inside his mind. He's sharing his mind with me. And some people understand it to be that way. He has disclosed himself to me. We're developing a more intimate relationship. I like that idea because God acts that way with his church, with his people. God has opened up his love and his mind to us and has chosen us. In Titus chapter 2 and verse 14, Christ gave himself up for us that he might redeem us from all iniquity and purify for himself a special people, zealous for good works. He has chosen us. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9, but you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may speak the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. He has chosen us. We are a special people, a chosen generation, a holy nation. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 1, behold what manner of love the Father has given us, that we should be called children of God. And such we are. Therefore, the world does not know us because it did not know him. What manner of love is this? That he chose us, that we should be called children of God. It is indeed amazing when we think about things like this. Another thing about this verse that I think is significant is the we. We will run after him. We will be glad and rejoice in you. We will remember your love. This is something pleasant. It's something right. It's something to rejoice in. Rightly do they love you. If your friends, if those around you are telling you that this guy or this girl is not a good person for you, the chances are he's not a good person for you, especially if you have godly friends, those who are older, your parents who care for you, religious people in the church. If they shake their heads when they see the relationship, it's probably not a good thing. Love is blind. And when you are infatuated with someone, it is difficult to think clearly. We need to be looking for red flags. And if you see them, address them before the marriage or get out of it as soon as possible. Do not get emotionally involved with someone and make it harder than it should be. In Proverbs chapter 24, verse 6, for by wise counsel you shall make war, and in a multitude of wise men there is safety. Everyone rejoices in this relationship. There's a multitude of wise men here, so it's safe. Proverbs 11, verse 14, very similar. Where there is no wisdom, the people fall, but in a multitude of wise men there is safety. Again, Proverbs 15 and verse 22, without wisdom, purposes are defeated, but by many wise men, they are established. If other people are telling you it's good and right, that's wonderful. If other people are telling you that they're concerned about this relationship, well, then we need to be concerned. You need to be concerned. Maybe it's not the best for you. When we consider this verse, we will run after you. We love you. We are drawn to you. I kind of think about running after God. God is so great because of his works, because his name is ointment poured forth. His works are everywhere. We see it. We want to be with God. A couple of verses that I came to are Psalm 119, verse 32 and verse 60. It says, "We will run the way of your commandments when you enlarge my heart." 119, verse 60, "I made haste and did not delay to keep your commandments." We run to God because of his greatness. Starting in verse 5, this woman says, "I am dark but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon." It seems throughout recorded history that the fairer skin of a woman was much to be desired. Snow White was the fairest of the land. You know, all throughout history, the whiter you were, the better off you were. It meant you didn't have to labor outside like a common person. You were elite, and that's the way it was. You were more beautiful the more white you are. It seems like just lately in history, a tan was more beautiful. But anyway, she says, "I'm dark." This is something she doesn't like about herself. She is self-cautious. She is ashamed of her looks. She feels bad about this. She doesn't want the daughters of Jerusalem to look at her in the next verse. But she does say she has self-worth. "I am dark, but I'm still lovely, like the curtains of Solomon, like the tents of Kedar." These things apparently were dark, but they were still good. They were still beautiful to look at. And so she notices that she has flaws in her looks, but she is still worth something. Notice what he says about her in contrast in verse 8. He says, "You are fair. You are lovely. You are the fairest among women," he says later on. We don't even see the flaws of those that we deeply love. These verses have their own context, but consider love covering sin. Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 12, "Hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all sins." 1 Peter 4 verse 8, "Above all things, have fervent love to yourselves, for love will cover a multitude of sins." In 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 4, "Charity," or love, "has patience, is kind." Charity is not envious, not vain, not puffed up. It is kind. It is tender. It is loving. We don't notice the flaws of others. We don't dwell on them. We don't see them. And I think this is a beautiful thing about Christ. Christ does not see our flaws if we are his people. In Ephesians chapter 5, verses 25 through 28, listen to how Christ and the man are to see only purity here. Ephesians 5, starting verse 25, "Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present to himself a glorious church without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So men ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself." So she says, "I'm dark, but I'm lovely." He says, "You are fair. You are white. You are beautiful." And that's the way we should be. Something about looks. "I am dark, but I'm still lovely." We should not pick a person because of their looks for quite a few reasons. First of all, looks deceive. Many people make themselves look good because all they care about is themselves. It doesn't matter what people look like. It matters who they are, and who they are is not their looks. Someone can look beautiful, but they could be stuck up and selfish and spoiled. And often, the person who doesn't look beautiful is not those things. So looks can deceive. There are many beautiful people that aren't stuck up. I didn't mean to say that. But looks can be deceiving. Also, looks decline. When someone gets older, they are not going to look as well as they did when they were younger. Often people look the best around the age that they're marrying. 20 and 30, as you get older, it goes downhill from there. And you understand that. If you marry someone for their looks, you're not going to be as attracted to them later on. So looks deceive, looks decline. And also, looks are devalued. Once you're married to someone, your friends, it doesn't matter much about the looks. Character always wins out. No one ever says, that person looks so good, and because of that, I can overlook the fact that he is so mean. That person is angry all the time, but he looks so good, so I'm happy to live with an angry person. She constantly complains about everything, but the way she looks makes up for it. No one says that. Looks will be devalued. In a relationship, it doesn't matter what the looks are as much as who the person is. Everyone would rather be married to someone who genuinely cares for them, who does good things, who is not seeking themselves, even if they are good looking. It doesn't matter. People want to be married to someone who genuinely cares despite the looks. In Proverbs 31, in verse 30, it says, "Favor is deceitful, and beauty is vain. But a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised." Beauty is vain. Beauty is nothing. We need to look at the character. The woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Verse 6, going along these same lines, "Do not look upon me because I am dark, because the sun has tanned me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard I have not kept." So here we have the reason she is dark. This tells us something about the woman and her character. And men, this is the type of character you need to look for in a woman. This verse tells us that she was not spoiled. Spoiled people will never be happy, and you will not be happy if you have to live with them for all eternity. You want someone who is not spoiled. She was humbled. She knows what it's like to be mistreated, and therefore she is less likely to mistreat others. I think about certain movies like The Man in the Iron Mask, if you've ever seen that. We don't want to be mistreated, and so we're going to be kind to others. She has a servant's heart, and she respects authority even when she's not happy with it. Notice all these times that Solomon talks about a nagging woman or something like that. Proverbs 12 and verse 4, "A woman of virtue is the crown of her husband, but she who causes shame is rottenness to the bones." Proverbs 19 and verse 13, "A foolish son is ruin to his father, and the quarreling wife is a never-ending dripping." Proverbs 21 verse 9, "It is better to dwell in the corner of a housetop than with a quarrelsome woman and share a house." Proverbs 21 verse 19, "It is better to dwell in the wilderness than them with a quarrelsome and angry woman." Proverbs 25:24, "It is better to dwell in the corner of the housetop than with a quarreling woman and share a house." Proverbs 27, verse 15, "A never-ending dripping on a very rainy day and a quarrelsome woman are alike." Now notice 1 Peter chapter 3, starting in verse 1. Listen to this. "Likewise, wives, be in subjection to your husband, so that if any do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives, having the witness of chaste behavior in the fear of God, of whom let not be the adorning of garments or the outward braiding of hair or wearing of gold or putting on of clothing, but let it be the hidden man of the heart, in which is not corruptible, the meek and quiet spirit, which is of great price in the sight of God. For so once indeed the holy women, hoping in God, adorned themselves, being in subjection to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose children you became, doing good and fearing no terror. This woman already respected authority. She had a servant's heart. She was humble. She knew what it was to be a hard worker, and this is the type of person that you want to marry. If someone is already respecting the authority that they're under, they're going to respect your authority. If someone is rebellious as a child, doesn't care for authority, they're not going to submit to your authority. And by the way, I'm not saying that husbands are greater than wives or anything like that, but the husband, by God's design, is the one in authority. He himself has to be in authority or under the authority of Christ. And so you always want someone who respects the authority that they are given. She is a hard worker. I think about Moses' wife, Zipporah, Rachel, Rebecca. They were all shepherds. They were all hard workers. When Abraham sent his servant to go get a wife for Isaac, Isaac said, "Let it be the person who I ask for water will also draw, who offers to draw water for the camels. She is going to be the one." This was not just a test, but it was a test of the character, not just a test of what the will of God would be, but it was a test of character. Camels drank a lot of water. And so he was testing the character. This would be the type of person he would want for Isaac to marry. In Proverbs chapter 31, verses 10 through the end of the chapter, particularly verse 27, it talks about how hard working this woman of virtue is. Many things in there talk about this woman of virtue. I guess we should quit there. I've run out of time. I wanted to cover more, but I'm glad you listened so far. If you're not married, look for these traits in the person you're looking to marry, if you are looking to marry. If you are married, have these traits in yourself. Make your spouse happy by developing these traits that God says, this is the type of person you want to marry. This is the type of person that will make you happy. Do this for your spouse. I hope we can have time later on to have another lesson in this. I really enjoyed preparing these lessons, and I hope you enjoy them as well. If you have any questions or any comments, we would love to hear from you. I always try to give you a way to contact us. If you want to email us, you can email us at mornings@tgrn.org. You can email me at Stephen, Steven, @tgrn.org. Or you can call us at 1-844, the word 4, F-O-R, T-G-R-N. That's the Gospel Radio Network. Or that number is 1-844-367-8476. If you have any questions or concerns, or if you'd like to contact us for any reason, you can get a hold of us. I do hope that you've enjoyed this lesson, and I hope more that this lesson impacts your life and it makes you want to be a better person for God. Thank you very much for listening.